Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th Canto, Chapter 1, Text 54. Shri Vasudeva Uvacha. Nahi asyaste bayam. No, nahi nayasyaste bayam somya. Nayasyaste bayam somya. Yadvai saha sariravak. Yadvai saha sariravak. Putran samarpayasyesya. Putran samarpayasyesya. Yataste bayam utitam. Yataste bayam utitam. Shri Vasudeva Vacha. Nayasyaste bayam somya. Yadvai saha sariravak. Putran samarpayasyesya. Yataste bayam utitam. Others. Shri Vasudeva Vacha. Vaishnavis. Uchan samarpayasi. Shri Vasudeva Vacha. Sri Vasudev said, Na, not, he, indeed, Asya, from Devaki, Te, of you, Bayam, fear, Somya, O most sober, Yat, which, Vai, indeed, Sa, that omen, Aha, dictated, Asharidavak, a vibration without a body, Putran, all my sons, Samar Payisye, I shall deliver to you, Asya, of her, Devaki, Yataha, from whom, Te, your, Bayam, fear, Utitam, has arisen. Translation and purport by Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Vasudev said, O best of the sober, you have nothing to fear from your sister Devaki because of what you have heard from the unseen omen. The cause of death will be her sons. Therefore, I promise that when she gives birth to the sons from whom your fear has arisen, I shall deliver them all unto your hands. Purport. Kamsa feared Devaki's existence because after her eighth pregnancy, she would give birth to a son who would kill him. Vasudev, therefore, to assure his brother-in-law the utmost safety, promised to bring him all the sons. He would not wait for the eighth son, but from the very beginning would deliver to the hands of Kamsa all the sons to which Devaki would give birth. This was the most liberal proposition offered by Vasudev to Kamsa. Om agina timiram dasya jananjana shalakaya chakshurna militam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha. Shri chaitanya manobishtam stapitam yena bhutale swayam rupakadamayam tadati swapadantikam. So, here we have Vasudev making a proposal to Kamsa. This wasn't the first. This one's going to work, actually. He's tried several that didn't really, went down like a lead balloon, as the expression goes. He tried initially to appeal to Kamsa's sense of honor. You know, he said, you're such a great Kshatriya, you're considered such a great hero, and how is it that you're thinking of killing your sister on this auspicious occasion, like that. And Krishna did something like that in the Bhagavad Gita in the second chapter to Arjuna. He said, people will always speak of your infamy. For one who is honored, dishonor is worse than death. The great generals who have highly esteemed your name and fame will think that you have left the battlefield out of fear only, and they'll consider you a coward. people will describe you in many unkind words and scorn your ability. What could be more painful to you than this, like that. So, he also used that line of logic. It's a standard approach. Anyway, Vasudev tried that on Kamsa, but it didn't work. Didn't work at all. And then he gave a bunch of philosophical reasons to him why he shouldn't go down this path of course of action, pursue this path of action of trying to kill his sister. And that didn't work. That had no effect either. And then he went back to, then he appealed to his emotions. Hey, this is her wedding day. She's your sister. She's deserving of your, compassion and affection and like that. You can't. How could you even consider killing her like that? That didn't work. And so now he's, as Devamrita Swami Maharaj really nicely pointed out, he's really thinking fast here because this is all happening. This is all happening in like a few seconds. They hear the omen, and the next thing you know, Kamsa is pulling out, grabs her head by the hair, and pulls out his sword, and he's ready to, kill her. He's ready to chop off her head or whatever. And the Suvasadeva really had to think fast. And I mean, if you consider the short little amount of time he had to do this, it was really, I mean, it's incredible that he was able to even come up with these many pitches, sort of angles, you know, to try to get Kamsa to desist, cease and desist from what he was planning on doing. So then Krishna gave him the intelligence to present this argument, which is that, well, hey, look, I mean, after all, it's not Devaki that you have to worry about. She's not, according to the omen, it's not her that's going to kill you. It's the eighth son. So it's the son that you have to fear, not Devaki. So logically, why kill Devaki? You know, I'm a man of my word of honor. I'm known for my, you know, keeping my word. So I give you my word of honor that I will deliver all the sons to you, not just the eighth son. I'll deliver all the sons to you, and you can kill them. You can do whatever you see is fit. And in this way, you have nothing to worry about, you know. And Vasudev, we're going to hear, he also did a kind of a profit loss calculation even previous to presenting this to Kamsa, and figured out, actually, in the meantime, I'll promise that, and I'll have to do it because I am somebody who keeps my word. I'm a man of, you know, my word of honor like that. So, you know, worst case scenario, or best case scenario, is that maybe something will happen and Kamsa will get killed before this, I have to do this. Or in any event, maybe one of the earlier sons will kill Kamsa. Or anyway, his final conclusion was, anyway, let me just do what I have to do right now to save Devaki, and I'll worry about this other stuff later, you know, because right now I just got to try to save her. So, you know, he was a pure devotee of Krishna, and so Krishna gave him a lot of intelligence even to come up with all this, these, you know, arguments and ideas, even up to this point. But aside from that, like, so, but this is here in the Bhagavatam, so, but what's so glorious about that in one sense? I mean, you know, here we have, okay, so somebody's trying to save his wife. So why is that worthy of being presented in the pages of the Srimad Bhagavatam, the 10th canto? I mean, any normal guy would try to do that. You know, I mean, not any, but a lot. There's a lot of people out there who, in that same situation, would do something, think fast, and try to come up with something to save their wife. But as once again, as His Holiness Devamrita Swami pointed out nicely in the class he gave, it was something. It was more than just that. I mean, that in and of itself that's nice. It's good. It's chivalrous and all that. But he had a motive to serve the mission of the Lord. You know, he heard that omen, and the omen was predicting that the eighth son will, you know, appearing in Devaki's womb will kill you. So, you know, he could understand that meant Krishna was going to come. And so he was trying to, also part of his motivation in doing all this, to, you know, to save Devaki so that the eighth son could be born and would, you know, kill Kamsa, which was, so he could understand somehow or another that this was, he had to do this to try to help serve Krishna's mission. You know, the fourth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Parichanaya sadhanam, how's it go? Parichanaya sadhanam vinishaya chaduskritam dharma samstarpanataya sambhavami yuge yuge. In order to deliver the pious and not the miscreants and reestablish the principles of religion, I event myself millennium after millennium. So somehow he could understand that was going on, and he was trying to do that. So that's a very important point. And that's a point that is worthy of being, you know, mentioned in the pages of the Bhagavatam, that he was prepared to sacrifice, not that only was he understanding that, yeah, I have to serve the mission of the Lord, but he was willing to sacrifice everything, or sacrifice a lot, to serve the mission of the Lord. I mean, it's no small thing to, because once again, he was a man of his word. So when he says, I'm going to give you, you know, when all these children are born, I'm going to come and, you know, present them to you, and you could do what you like, that means he was going to do it. And he knew he would do it, because that's the kind of, you know, person, he had a reputation for that, and that's the kind of person he was. So basically, he was prepared to sacrifice all his children, you know, if that's what it took. He was sacrifice his children to serve the mission of the Lord like that, if that's what was required. So that's a big sacrifice. And so that's, you know, a very important thing here. And it's something that... This is a very important point. It's a point that's not... Another way of presenting this same thing is sincerity of purpose. You know, it ties in with that, sincerity of purpose. And it's a point that needs to be, always needs to be more well understood, even within our society. I'll give you an example. Try to bring it home now, make some sense out of this. Okay, so a lot of times, like, managers within ISKCON get criticized, you know, and as managers all over the world do, right? As soon as you're in a position of leadership, you get criticized, right? You know, all the national leaders throughout the world get criticized, and with no exception, our managers within ISKCON get criticized. They get criticized for, they're persecuting these people, and that this person wasn't dealt with fairly. But sometimes what the rank and file fail to see is that the managers, be it a temple president or a GBC or whatever, anybody, you know, anybody in a position of like leadership and having to make decisions which affect others, they're trying to do a service. You know, it's not that they're trying to just lord it over the people that they're in charge of and make life difficult for them, for them and for everybody else. No, they're trying to do a service. So sometimes what we fail to understand is how they're trying to serve the mission of the Lord, right? They're trying to serve the mission of the Lord. You know, the GBC don't exist to make life difficult, say, for all the members of ISKCON. Well, the temple presidents don't exist to, you know, strike fear in the heart of all the devotees in the temple and just make life miserable for everybody. No, they're trying to do a service. They're trying to serve the mission of ISKCON. And they have, generally speaking, you know, they have a lot of sincerity of purpose. We should have that sort of faith. Ultimately, ISKCON is under the control of Krishna, ultimately, and it's probably a good attitude, a good mentality to have that, well, this person's in this position because ultimately Prabhupada and Krishna felt that they are the comparatively most advantageous person to be in this position, and therefore they have, you know, a certain amount of sincerity of purpose, a certain significant amount of desire to serve the mission of the Lord. Let me cooperate. You know, let me try to appreciate what it is that they're trying to do and cooperate and not be constantly, you know, not have an attitude of criticizing and, you know, just thinking that, why is it, you know, like not appreciating. So that's an important point, and it works both ways. Now you could take that, what I just said, and just spin it around, and you could have it the other way around. And the managers, you know, the leaders, they need to see that in the... In the people, you know, in the devotees, in the followers, in the rank and file, that they have to be just like we, you know, as the ordinary devotees, we have to see, okay, what's the motivation here? Is it to serve the mission of the Lord that this, you know, new rule and regulation is coming down, or this restriction or instruction is here, or is it just because they're just, you know, to make arrangement for their own sense gratification, their own convenience? And same time, the leaders need to try to see this person is doing like this. What is their motivation? Where is their head at, so to speak? Is this something that's coming about as a result of their desire to sincerely serve the mission of the Lord, or just something else? And once again, this is a really important point to understand if the movement is going to move forward in a progressive way. Prabhupada said that this movement won't be destroyed by from without, but from within. It could be. You know, he didn't say would be, but he said it could be. And this is how it'll come unhinged, you know, if this understanding isn't there. Because then there won't be cooperation. You know, everybody, there'll be antagonism between, you know, leadership and membership. And it'll just really mess things up. You know, things will come grind to a halt like that. Grind to a standstill is the expression. So, it's a really important point to understand. And there's that famous anecdote, which I'm not even sure how completely bona fide it is, but devotees quote it. I've probably quoted it many hundreds of times in classes from the Ramayana, where Hanuman was, they were trying to build that bridge across from the mainland to Sri Lanka, and Hanuman was taking these big boulders and throwing them in there, and then supposedly there was this little spider, and he was just taking little grains of sand and dust or whatever, and he was kind of, you know, doing his thing, and he was pitching them in there. And Hanuman, at one point, just kind of just said to him, said, look, do me a favor, just can you get out of the way? You know, you're doing nothing, basically. I mean, look, I'm carrying these big boulders, and, you know, and you're just, if anything, you're just an impediment here, because I'm constantly have to worry about stepping on you and crushing you. So just go over there and just relax. We'll take care of it, you know. And so Lord Ramachandra happened to be witness this whole thing, and then he corrected Hanuman. He said, no, that's the wrong attitude. He's, as far as I'm concerned, he's doing as much, his service is just as significant as yours. He's doing as much service as you're doing, you see. So it's obvious that from that story, it's a very, whether it really is in the Ramayana or not, I don't know. But it's obvious from that story that what Lord Ramachandra was really concerned about was not the external, but the internal, you know, the sincerity of purpose. He could understand that this spider had as much, you know, desire to serve the mission of the Lord, had as much sincerity of purpose as Hanuman, and he appreciated that. You know, he appreciated it. He appreciated it as much as, you know, as Hanuman, like that. So he appreciated the spider, even though he was just taking little grains of sand there, as he did Hanuman. So it's, you know, it's a really important point that we have to try to see that in each other. And if you're feeling, if you're in a situation where you're feeling, well, okay, yeah, I'm trying to do that. I feel like I'm trying to do that. But I don't feel like people are trying to do that with me. I don't feel my sincerity of purpose is being appreciated. I don't feel like my, you know, desire to serve the mission of the Lord is being properly appreciated and acknowledged. So, but, you know, even though, despite the fact that I'm trying to do that, you know, with I'm extending that to others, but it's not coming back. I'm not, you know, well, just be patient. Be patient. That would be my advice. If you feel like you're in that position where, you know, you're trying to appreciate the sincerity of purpose in other devotees and see how they're serving the mission of the Lord, but it's not, you know, you're not, it's not coming back to you, so to speak, then hang in there. But why? Because ultimately Krishna's in control. Krishna's in control. And Krishna is within everyone's heart. And Krishna will, understanding that that's what the case is, that you really are, you know, acting, you know, with a proper motivation. You have a lot of sincerity of purpose. You really are trying to serve the mission of the Lord. Krishna will at some point adjust things, and you'll experience, you'll that reciprocation will be there. And one of the reasons possibly why it's not there, assuming that you really are acting with a lot of sincerity of purpose and desire to serve the mission of the Lord, Krishna's testing. Krishna tests. He tests the devotees, you know. It could just be a test from Krishna to really, you know, to see how sincere you really are. So you got to persevere. You know, you got to be prepared to try to, you know, act with a lot of sincerity of purpose, serve the mission of the Lord. And if it's not being appreciated, if you feel like you're being misunderstood, you know, and not appreciated, then just keep on, just persevere. Because, as I said, Krishna's in control, and it's just a matter of time. Krishna will reciprocate, and everything will work out fine. And that's, we see examples of that in the lives of the great devotees, you know, how Krishna tests, and at some point Krishna, when Krishna's satisfied, you know, that this devotee has passed the test, then everything gets, you know, Krishna takes care of everything. And as I said, there's, you know, so many examples of that. Of course, Prabhupada would be, is always a classic, great example to mention. You know, Srila Prabhupada was, you know, had a lot of sincerity of purpose, and initially nothing was happening. You know, when Prabhupada first came to America, he was here in the United States for almost a year before anything really started happening. You know, and he describes how we heard very nicely, I think, Radhanath Maharaj in the last Sunday feast lecture he gave, he read an excerpt, or he didn't read it, but he mentioned an excerpt Prabhupada wrote in his diary when he was on the boat coming over on the Jaladuta, and it was Janmashtami. So Prabhupada was expressing how you know, all my God brothers, all the Vaishnavas, they're over there in Vrindavan or Mayapur, they're in some temple and they're celebrating this occasion and, you know, the association of the devotees, and there's a nice festival and everything. Here I am on this boat and I don't have any association. I don't, you know. But I'm not resentful because I'm, you know, I know I'm serving the mission of the Lord. So in other words, Prabhupada was in a difficult, you know, he voluntarily accepted a lot of difficulty initially there to serve the mission of the Lord. He had a lot of sincerity of purpose. But as I said, you know, there's a lot of reverses, you know, the heart attacks. And then even when he went to New York, nothing was happening initially. You know, nobody was showing much serious interest. And there was one letter, which I've mentioned previous in classes, but I'll just briefly refer to it again, where Prabhupada wrote to Sudama, and a disciple of his, and he said, "When I was alone in New York, I was thinking, who will listen to me in this horrible, sinful place? Yeah? But at least I could distribute a few of my books. That is something." And then his next sentences are really revealing. He said, "But Krishna was all along planning something I could not see." I say, Krishna was all along planning something I could not see. He brought you nice young American boys and girls to me one by one, you know, for helping to spread the mission of Lord Chaitanya. He said, to be trained up to spread the mission of Lord Chaitanya. He said, now I could see it as a miracle. He says, otherwise, one old man in your city of New York with barely enough money to buy edibles, how could he survive? What to speak of spreading a God-conscious movement for the, you know, to save the whole human race. See? So in other words, Prabhupada, he saw himself in that situation. That's how he perceived his own situation, that he was, you know, he was struggling like that on one level. And but Krishna was all along planning something he could not see. See, so that's the key sentence here. We have to have that faith. Just like Prabhupada did, you know, he didn't, even if he felt a little discouraged, you know, he didn't give up. Prabhupada persevered. Prabhupada was a no-breaking-point devotee. No-breaking-point devotee. There's no point at which Prabhupada was, you know, throwing in the towel. Even if he made some overtures or, you know, some noises or, you know, like he went down to the office a couple times to ask that guy, when's the next boat going back to, you know, the India on the Jaladutta. He might have, you know, superficially done a few little things, but Prabhupada was just determined. He was going to go down fighting, and just like we heard the other day from Surat Prabhu, how in New York City, Prabhupada was in the elevator there, and it was 1976, and he was ill. He had a cold or a flu or something like that. So the devotees were encouraging him, Prabhupada, stay here. Stay here for a while. Just rest up. You know, you don't have to go right away. I mean, just stay here for another week or two and, you know, regain your health and do whatever, take it easy. And then we'll change all the, make all the arrangements with the travel. And Prabhupada had his walking stick. He was in the elevator with all these sannyasi leaders and he banged down his walking stick. He said, look, you know, give me the right, you know, just give me the right to fight for Krishna till my last breath, something like that. I sort of quoted it. I can't remember the exact words, but you know, that was Prabhupada's mood. No breaking point. No breaking point. There wasn't like a point at which Prabhupada was going to, you know, change his determination to just sacrifice everything to try to spread the mission of the Lord. So, of course, you know, Krishna reciprocated with him. He gave him a movement. You know, Prabhupada had nothing there. He was in New York, and he said he was just by himself. He was all, when I was alone, and you're in New York at that point. He was referring to 1966, you know. As I said, he was in New York almost a year before anything started happening, before they got that temple, 26th and, Street, 2nd Avenue in New York. So, you know, he was feeling like that. I was alone in New York. I was thinking, who will listen to me in this horrible, sinful place? Maybe I could distribute a few books. But Krishna reciprocated and gave him a movement, you see? So that's how it works. That's how it works. And, you know, the same thing is there for us. We have to, you know, take that as, that's an example, and that's, you know, what we should be thinking like that, to follow like that, that just have to be prepared. You know, we have our service, and we have to be prepared to just try to really, you know, surrender and persevere. And even if it appears like it's not working, it's not happening, this is not working, you know, something's going wrong. No, just keep on, and Krishna's right there, all the Krishna's all along preparing something we cannot see. He's in the background, and at the, you know, at the right point in time meaning when Krishna's satisfied with the sincerity of our effort, our endeavor to surrender, then he'll reciprocate, and everything will be there. And that's, he wrote that. There was a letter to Brahmananda. Brahmananda wrote Prabhupada something of asking about Krishna's mercy or Krishna's kindness. And Prabhupada wrote back, regarding Krishna's being kind upon us should be on the principle that Arjuna followed. Arjuna was Krishna's best friend, and he could have given Arjuna victory just without any, you know, without Arjuna doing anything. But Prabhupada said, but neither was that principle wasn't followed, you know, by Krishna or Arjuna. He said, so Prabhupada goes on to say, so ordinarily too, we have to try our best, to our best capacity to achieve something. And then by Krishna's grace, all of a sudden, we shall see everything is there. See, this sort of help from Krishna is transcendental happiness. See, so in other words, that's how it works. We have to just, you know, be prepared to really surrender, try our best and everything. Struggle. That's Krishna. Might sound a little cruel, but Krishna likes to see the struggle. Krishna likes to see the devotees struggling to surrender and serve him. And then, you know, when he does, then all of a sudden we shall see. Everything will be there. And that, and then Prabhupada, the next sentence is, that sort of help from Krishna is transcendental happiness. And it's transcendental happiness because it's more than just that you all of a sudden experience the fruit of your endeavors, you know, the success in what you're trying to do. But it's simultaneously, it's like you get the realization that, wow, this is for real. Krishna's for real. Krishna really does exist. Krishna really is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and he really is helping me, you know, and it's like a very tangible, palpable experience, you know. So that's why Papa says this sort of help from Krishna is transcendental happiness. Okay? And that's always, that possibility is always there. We, you know, just have to kind of remind ourselves that it's always there. We should never feel completely, you know, discouraged. In Bhagavad Gita chapter 9, text 5, in the purport, Prabhupada says something. He says, we may think of doing something, but there may be impediments. There may be impediments. And sometimes it's not possible to do as we like. But then he says, but when Krishna wants to do something, simply by his willing, everything happens so perfectly that one cannot imagine how it is being done. You see? So, that's Krishna. You know, earlier in that same purport, Prabhupada says, paragraph, he says, his determination is itself actual fact. His determination is itself actual fact. So, you know, just have to remind ourselves, we're dealing with Krishna. You know, something Prabhupada said that, just, you're dealing with Krishna. So it's different. It's totally different than being out in the material world and, you know, the way things work with the material energy. This is devotional service is conducted under the auspices of the internal potency of the Lord. There's that verse, Mahatmanas tumam parta daivim prakritim ashrita bhajanti ananyamanaso gyatva bhutadim aviyam, that daivim prakritim ashrita, it's under the control of the internal potency. So, you know, that the determination is itself actual fact potency. So for devotees, it's a different ball game. We just have to, and we have to remember that, and that'll help us, you know, continue with determination. And if you're feeling upon hearing this that it's just too much, it's kind of like this is too high a, you know, too high a standard. You just kind of feel like overwhelmed by the, you know, what's required of you to be in the devotional service. And well, don't worry. Don't worry because, you know, yeah, it's true that we're trying to do something that's very, you know, very hard in one sense. And I mean, just even this morning we heard, we read the Bhagavatam, I read it actually, that Bhagavatam purport, where Prabhupada says, nobody goes back to Godhead in one lifetime. Yeah? Nobody goes back to Godhead in one lifetime. So, you know, it's kind of like, whoa, what did I get myself into here? You know, this is hard. This is the hardest thing I've ever tried to do in my life, and I'm not, you know, it's kind of, I don't even know if I'm doing it successfully. But, and then you hear something like that, nobody goes back to Godhead in one lifetime. And in the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada says, in one purport, he says, we've had many, many millions of births here in this material world. So, you know, something you could feel discouraged, but But on the other hand, actually, there's no need to be discouraged. At least this is what I preach to myself. Actually, just recently, this last few days, the 13th, 14th, 15th, and 16th of April are like every year I kind of, it's a special time of the year for me because that's 1973, April 13th, 14th, 15th, and 16th was like the turning point in my life. On April 13th, it's actually a Friday the 13th in that particular year, I was going home from Amala Bhakti's Hatha Yoga Center. He was managing a Hatha Yoga Center in Midtown Manhattan. And I was doing some service there. So I was just kind of going home from there, and I was just ready to go into the subway on 59th Street and Lexington Avenue. And a devotee, dressed in, dhoti and kurta, approached me and handed me a Teachings of Lord Chaitanya. And, he did his pitch there, his spiel, and they asked me for a donation. Anyway, I'm going to make a long story very, very short. But so I did. I got that book, and I read it. I was reading it the whole way, home on the subway, just... Even I was packed in like packed in like sardines is the expression. So that's because it was rush hour Friday, and I was just I wasn't worried about falling because I couldn't. There's no way to fall. There was people in front, on the side, in the back, So I just held up by all the people, and I just was reading that book the whole time I was on the train. I read it as I was walking from the subway back to the apartment, my parents' place which is where I was staying, and I read it. I kept reading it till about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. Because I was finding it fascinating. And I remember thinking to myself, you know what? I don't even know if I understand what I'm reading here. But I really like this. So I just read it till I finished it, kind of. Towards the end there, it got very esoteric. I know I was kind of fudging over some parts there. But I basically read it all the way through. And then I decided, okay, I gotta get one of those Srimad Bhagavatams. So so the next day, I thought, okay, well, where do I go? Where is this temple? So I looked in the book, and there was no address. There was no phone number. There was an address, Tiffany Place in Brooklyn. So I thought, maybe that's where it is. But that was for the press. At that time, the ISKCON Press was in Tiffany Place in Brooklyn. So back in those days, there was no MapQuest. There was no Google, So I rang the directory assistants, and I asked them, I said, hey, if I give you an address, can you tell me in Brooklyn, can you tell me where it is? And I said, no, we don't do that. We give phone numbers. So I said, well, what do I do? She said, go to the library, maybe look in an almanac or something like that. So the next morning, which was Saturday morning, I went to the library and asked for an almanac, but they couldn't help me either. So I just decided I'll get on the train. I'll go back to the same place. Maybe that's where these guys hang out, and I'll see, So I hopped on the train. I took all my worldly possessions with me at that point, which was about $34. And I got back on the train. And I went back down to 59th and Lexington. As I was coming up out of the train, a different devotee, was coming down into the train, and he saw me, and he handed me a long stem rose, and he asked for a donation. So I said, yeah, sure, I'll give you a donation. I handed him a couple dollars. I said, but what I'm really interested in is, do you have any of those Srimad Bhagavatams? And he just about fell over backwards, because who in 1973 asked you for a Srimad Bhagavatam? So he said, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, I do. I have three of them here. I have First Canto, Part 1, 2, and 3. I said, well, he said, no, as a matter of fact, I do. And I said to him, so how many can you give me for $30? I was a simple guy, I said, how many can you give me for $30? He said, well, I can give you the First Canto, Part 1, 2, and 3. I said, that sounds like a fair deal, $10 a book, So he gave them to me, and then we were talking. And then he was smart enough to see that, well, maybe this guy's something more than just a customer. So he decided, he told me, well, why don't you come to the temple and the Sunday feast is tomorrow and blah, blah, blah. So I said, okay, yeah, sounds great. He said, and look, can I ask you a favor? I said, what's that? He said, well, those are the only three Bhagavatams I have. Can I just give you one of them? And I'll give you the other two when you come to the temple tomorrow. And I said, okay, got to see if these guys got to at least be honest. These books are talking about love of God and everything. And well, if it's any of it's true, they got to at least be honest. So I said, okay. So I took the First Canto, Part 1, and I just, he took back the other two, and I just turned around, got back on the subway, and headed back up to the Bronx and, read that for the Saturday. And then the next day I went to the temple, and I was, kind of impressed by what I saw. Anyway, I'm going to just make a long story short. But I met Mother Divi Shakti. She gave me a beautiful poster of Krishna Balaram and a little 45 RPM. When I opened up the poster, it was that one where Krishna Balaram used to be on the cover of the Krishna book. And I saw that picture, and I thought to myself, and it is true, I looked and I said, wow, those are the two most beautiful people I've ever seen. I just was like really struck by the beauty of the facial features in particular of Krishna and Balaram. I just, wow. And I heard that Prabhupada said nice things about that painting. You know, subsequently I heard that he said whoever painted that, maybe it was Bharadwaj, I can't remember, whoever, but it said, has seen this, you know, seen the spiritual world or something like that. Prabhupada appreciated that painting. So I saw that and I was really impressed. And then I thought, well, I got this. I was home now. I was back in the apartment after the Sunday feast. And I'm leaving out a bunch of details, but I'm watching the clock at the same time. But so I said, okay, well, let me check out this record. Actually, before that, I was marching around my room chanting Hare Krishna, the tune I heard at the temple that night. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna. And I was experiencing a higher taste. You know, I was experiencing a higher taste. And so I was kind of really getting into it. And then I hear, and at the door, you know, so I go to the door and it was my father. And he goes, Jeff, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm just chanting. I just, you know, I was at this Hare Krishna temple. I learned this mantra. He said, do you know what time it is? I said, well, no, actually, it's 11:30. Your mother and I are trying to get to sleep. Could you please be a little bit more considerate? I said, oh, sorry, Dad. So I decided, okay, stop the chanting. So then but I was wide awake, you know, I wasn't at all sleepy. So I thought, okay, let me put on the record and listen to that. So the first side was Govinda Jaya Jaya Gopala Jaya. So I put that on. I played that once. I said, yeah, that's nice, but, you know, that wasn't like... But then I put on the other side, and it was the Govindam prayers. And I heard, you know, all of a sudden, I heard, Govind, like we hear every morning, you know? And when I heard that, I went, whoa, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever heard, you know? And I loved it. And I played it again and again and again. And each time, probably, I was making it a little louder because I was just kind of like, you know, really enjoying. So I must have played it about a dozen times. And then I heard... And it was my father again. And, you know, he was upset even more. And he said, look, we got a problem. Can you please be quiet? I said, okay, is that so? So, I had to stop playing that. And then I was still wide awake and I was really kind of, you know, I don't want to say wired up. I felt like Krishna was giving me the mercy. I was experiencing like some level of ecstasy. So I rang up the temple. And somehow somebody answered, actually, Brajendranandana. You know him. He was the temple commander at the time, and he's sleeping in the shoe room where the only phone was. And he answered. Archie was smiling because he remembers all this kind of detail. And I said, hey, you know what? So I described to him what was going on. I said, I was at the temple. I'm really, you know, really liking this and blah, blah, blah. Can I come? Can I come down? I'd like to come down right now. And he said, well, he said, since he said, you know, hey, well, you know what time it is? I said, well, no. It's about 1:30 in the morning or something. But he said, why don't you... for 12 at night, 12 midnight. So why don't you get a good night's sleep? You know, we'll be here tomorrow morning. You know, just come down tomorrow when you have to. You know. So, okay, sure. So I went to lie down to go to sleep. I fell asleep for about 3 hours. And when I woke up, it was like somebody turned the light switch on. Most times when I wake up, I kind of wake up and I'm half asleep, half awake, half asleep, and it takes a few minutes before you just kind of really... But this, on this particular occasion, I remember, I was just like... Somebody turned on a light switch. I was wide awake, feeling completely refreshed after, you know, just like a few hours sleep. And I did something I didn't normally ever do. I hopped into the shower and took a bath and put on clean clothes even, you know. I don't know why. That wasn't my habit, you know. And I just hopped on the subway and went down to the temple. And when I got there, they let me in straight away. Brajendranandana happened to be there. And they let me in. And I was there with the devotees. It was right after Mangal Arati. And they were chanting. And then some other devotees came over to Brajendranandana and they said, hey, what are you doing? You know, because at that time I had a beard and like a big thing of hair, you know. And they said, what are you doing? You know, you don't know. This guy could be crazy for all you know, you know. Let's see, you've got to test his sincerity. So they asked me to go outside and clean out the front of the building, something like that, you know. So I said, sure, yeah. So I went out there, and 5 minutes I was kind of sweeping away and, you know, raking up the leaves and all that. And finally they just said, okay, come on in, you know. And that was it, you know. I got to stay. At that time they had an apartment. It was about, you know, a few blocks away from the temple. It was called like a halfway house. And there was an arrangement so that people like myself who came and they wanted to experience temple life, they could stay there in that apartment for 3 nights. And, you know, that way they could get an experience. But then they have to go home. So after 3 days were up, which would be tomorrow, the 16th, I moved in 19, the temple, acting temple president was Nitai, at the time, he came up to me and said, "Okay, hey, look, you know, you've been here 3 nights now. You got to, you know, you got to go, and you can come, but just you got to come from home." And I said, "Oh, geez, I live all the way up in the Bronx, man. It's like an hour and a half by train, and you know, it's a lot of wasted time traveling there and back. I could be doing here doing service, you know. I said, what do you think? I mean, can you?" He said, "Ah, it's a policy, man. We can." I said, "Well, can you make an exception?" And I badgered him, harassed him enough so that he just said, "Well, look, okay, you could stay till the temple president gets back, you know, which was like another few days or a week, and then, you know, he'll decide. He'll decide if you can stay, whatever, permanently." And so he gave me a concession there, and he let me stay. And when temple president came back, it was Bali Mardan at the time. They just interviewed me. He asked me to read to him from the teachings of Lord Chaitanya. I guess they wanted to see if I was literate or whatever. And you know, so I did for just a minute or two, and he said, "Okay." And I remember he was sitting on an asana. It was something like a vyasasana, and he just leaned back, you know. And he said, "I'd really like to see you become Krishna conscious, Bhakta Jeff, you know." And I remember, like, I felt really blissful. It was just the whole atmosphere was just kind of blissful, you know. And he just said that, and he said, "Yeah, you could stay. You could stay. You can move into the ashram." And that was it. And it was Krishna's mercy. So anyway, I've kind of run out of time, so I'll stop now. But anyway, yeah, so I'll make one last point. So yeah, the only defeat in Krishna consciousness, the only failure, is if we give up, if we stop trying. Otherwise, there's no defeat. There's no failure. I mean, and that's not sentiment. That's shastra. That's philosophy. And I take advantage of this point periodically. I remind myself, like in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, there's this very nice verse in chapter 8 of Adi Lila, where it says, "If one, even with some slight faith, if one chants the holy names of Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda, he's very quickly freed from the reactions of his offenses, and then he'll be able, when he chants the Maha Mantra, he'll experiencing the ecstasy of love of God." And in the purport, Prabhupada says more than once, maybe like twice, three times, he makes the point that despite one's disqualifications, anyone who takes shelter of Guru Garanga, Gornatai, and chants the Panchatattva Mantra, you know, becomes free from the reactions to their offenses. And then when they chant the Hare Krishna Mantra, they'll be able to, you know, experience the love of God like that. So that's there. That's there. I mean, you know, Shastra for us is perfect, right? So, you know, we're accepting all these other things. So that, for me, I just accept, okay, that's a fact. So that's why I say there's always hope. We're misunderstanding if we're thinking there's no hope. We get discouraged. No, there's always hope. And that hope is, take shelter of Lord Chaitanya, take shelter of Lord Nityananda. And all else fails, or even before that, don't wait for that. But if all else fails, take shelter of Gornatai, take shelter of Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda, chant the Panchatattva Mahamantra. And according to that statement in the Adi Lila, that despite all one's disqualifications, one becomes free from reactions to offenses and, you know, will be elevated to a higher platform and be able to progress in spiritual life. So thank you very much for your kind attention. Grantarad Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
Turn it off.
Oh, turn it off. I thought you said turn it off.
Turn it off.
Okay.